investigation.
There are many unanswered questions after an ICE agent killed a woman in Minneapolis yesterday.
We'll bring you the latest from Minnesota this Thursday, January 8th on All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The Senate pushed back on President Trump's military threats against Venezuela.
Five Republicans joined Democrats to advance a resolution to stop Trump from ordering new military action.
It's a clear rejection of the idea that one person can unilaterally send American sons and daughters into harm's way.
And in California, the comeback of the Cascades frog.
Biologists want to bring them back to Lassen Volcanic National Park.
These were the first individuals to re-enter their historic home. And it's a really hopeful moment, I think, for Cascades frogs.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. The Trump administration continues to express support for the immigration agent who shot and killed 37-year-old Renee Nicole Good in Minneapolis yesterday. The agent, Jonathan Ross, was involved in another incident last summer. His arm was trapped in a vehicle and he was dragged as he attempted to arrest a man. As NPR's Jasmine Garst reports, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem says he was following his training.
Secretary Noem says the officer who fired the shots was, quote, surrounded and assaulted and locked in by protesters. She says the woman who was killed, Renee Nicole Good, bears responsibility.
They were impeding our law enforcement operations, which is against the law. And when they demanded and commanded her to get out of her vehicle several times, she did not.
Democrats have condemned the shooting, saying the administration's account conflicts with the evidence captured in multiple videos. The FBI has said there is an investigation underway. Minnesota officials say they've been forced to withdraw from the investigation after not being given complete access to the evidence, witnesses, and information. Jasmine Garst, NPR News, New York.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has met with a former UN diplomat who's expected to be on President Trump's Board of Peace for Gaza. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports Trump's peace plan is still in phase one, nearly 3 months after he announced it.
President Trump has said he will chair the Board of Peace, but he hasn't yet named anyone else, nor has he stood up a promised international force for Gaza. The man widely believed to be tapped for a key post is Nikolai Mladenov, a Bulgarian diplomat who worked for a decade as the UN Special Coordinator for the Middle East peace process until 2020. Prime Minister Netanyahu's office says he met with Mladenov and reiterated that Hamas must be disarmed in Gaza. The statement says that Mladenov will be the director general of the Peace Council there. President Trump is expected to name his board soon. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Congressional forecasters think the U.S. economy will grow a little bit faster this year than it did in 2025. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the new economic outlook also projects that inflation will remain stubbornly high.
The new forecast from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office predicts that economic growth will rev up slightly this year, goosed by the extended tax cut that congressional Republicans passed last summer. GDP is projected to grow 2.2%, compared to a little less than 2% in 2025. The economic boost from the tax cut is expected to be partially offset, however, by President Trump's tariffs, which are a drag on the economy, and his immigration crackdown, which limits the size of the workforce. Inflation is expected to fall only slightly and end the year well above the Federal Reserve's 2% target, but congressional forecasters still think the Fed will continue to cut short-term interest rates. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Wall Street closed mixed today. This is NPR News. The Trump administration and Louisiana officials have lifted another decades-old school desegregation order. A federal judge approved a joint motion from Louisiana and the Justice Department to dismiss a 1967 lawsuit in a school district in the northwestern part of the state. It's part of a campaign to end court orders the DOJ describes as outdated. College football's semifinals begins tonight in Arizona. The winner gets a spot in the championship game. Steve Futterman reports from Phoenix.
In the first semifinal tonight, Mississippi takes on Miami. Ole Miss, which has lost just once this season, has had to overcome a major distraction. Its head coach during the regular season, Lane Kiffin, left the team in November to take over the coaching duties at LSU. Mississippi quarterback Trinidad Chambliss.
It was a little difficult and it was a little tough on the team. A lot of other people had, you know, different opinions on the situation, and I feel like our team handled it the best they could.
Tomorrow, the second semifinal matches the nation's number one team, undefeated Indiana, against Oregon. The winners tonight and tomorrow will face off for the national championship on January 19th. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Phoenix.
A new study finds that some dogs can learn the names of new toys by eavesdropping. 10 gifted dogs watched their owners hold a new toy and talk to another person about it. Then the pups were told to go to another room and retrieve that specific toy from a pile. 7 out of 10 succeeded. Only a select group of dogs is capable of this, and scientists aren't yet sure what's behind it. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Lemelson Foundation, dedicated to improving lives through invention, innovation, and climate action. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantFDN.org.
It is 6 minutes past the hour, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next on All Things Considered is the Minneapolis shooting update. The Cohasset Parks and Rec Department has snowshoe hikes at Tioga Recreation Area on Mondays and Thursdays at 1:30. Meet at the bike trail parking lot. The city will provide snowshoes if you don't have them. All experience levels welcome. And coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. A day after an Immigration and Customs Enforcement agency fatally shot a woman in Minneapolis, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz is questioning whether there will be a fair and impartial investigation. Authorities initially said that Minnesota police would work hand-in-hand with the FBI to sift through evidence in the killing of Renee Good. But this morning, state officials said that the FBI had reversed course and would go at it alone. Joining us from Minneapolis with the latest is reporter Matt Sepik of Minnesota Public Radio. Hi, Matt.
Hi.
Matt, a lot has happened on the story since yesterday, and today we heard from the vice president, I know. Tell us the latest.
Yesterday morning, the ICE agent, who's been identified in unrelated court documents as Jonathan Ross, shot and killed Renee Good, a 37-year-old mother of three, after she'd partially blocked a Minneapolis street. Good was driving away from a group of agents who were on foot when Ross shot her in the head through her windshield. President Trump called Good a professional agitator, and today, Vice President J.D. Vance doubled down and defended the ICE agent's actions, saying that he fired in self-defense.
Everybody who's been repeating the lie that this is some innocent woman who was out for a drive in Minneapolis when a law enforcement officer shot at her, you should be ashamed of yourselves.
But several witnesses recorded video of the incident. In the footage, agents order Good to get out of her vehicle and one tries to open her car door. But she backs up, then drives forward and turns to the right away from the officers. It does not appear that she was trying to run them over, as Trump administration officials allege.
And Matt, I've seen from the reporting that only the FBI will be investigating this shooting. This investigation will no longer include Minnesota officials. Do we know why?
Well, in a statement this morning, Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension Superintendent Drew Evans said that yesterday afternoon, the FBI told him that the Minnesota U.S. Attorney's Office, part of the Justice Department, had reversed course and decided that the FBI would lead the investigation on its own. Evans said the BCA, quote, has reluctantly withdrawn from the investigation because the FBI is not sharing case materials. I reached out to the U.S. Attorney's Office here for comment, but did not hear back.
What's Minnesota's governor had to say about this turn of events in the investigation?
Governor Tim Walz, who's a Democrat, held another news conference today. He said the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension includes experienced professionals that have built trust with the community, particularly for their role in investigating the police murder of George Floyd back in 2020.
It feels now that Minnesota has been taken out of the investigation. It feels very, very difficult that we will get a fair outcome. And I say that only because people in positions of power have already passed judgment.
Governor Walz again urged Minnesotans to protest peacefully.
Now, if criminal charges are warranted against the ICE agent who shot and killed Good and federal prosecutors decline to file them, at that point, could the state step in?
Yes. University of Wisconsin legal scholar Brenna Goddard says a state can prosecute a federal agent if the agent acts in an improper manner in the course of their duties. And she says if Agent Ross is charged and convicted, he could not get a pardon from President Trump.
Because the criminal charges in this hypothetical would still be for state law crimes, if the officer was convicted, then the president could not pardon him. The president can only pardon individuals for federal crimes, not state crimes.
And how likely is a charge from state officials?
Well, I should emphasize here that this is still very much a hypothetical scenario. State prosecutors are far from making any charging decisions.
That was Matt Sepik of Minnesota Public Radio. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Seventeen House Republicans joined with Democrats to pass a measure that would extend health insurance subsidies that lapsed at the end of last year. But that three-year extension is unlikely to pass the Senate, where a similar measure failed in December. We do know, though, a bipartisan group of senators say they are nearing a compromise to resurrect the subsidies. Here to help us sort through all of that, NPR congressional reporter Sam Greenglass, who's tracking it from Capitol Hill. Hey, Sam.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Okay. So there are a lot of moving parts here. Let's start with a central player, the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, who we know opposes these subsidies, vehemently opposes them. He has the ability to control what gets a vote in the House. How did this measure even get to the floor?
Yeah, so for weeks, the Speaker refused to hold a vote on the subsidies, despite more than a dozen members of his caucus pressing him to. So four Republicans joined with Democrats to force a vote using a maneuver called a discharge petition that until recently has been used relatively sparingly.
Okay, so these four Republicans, they force a vote. We know that even more are backing the legislation. This seems like a blow to Speaker Johnson, no?
Well, he would not describe it that way. Johnson has told reporters that this is just the reality of having a paper-thin majority. But the Speaker has now been circumvented several times during this Congress. It was also a discharge petition that forced the vote to release the Epstein files. Democrats are heralding this subsidies vote as a vindication of their strategy to withhold votes from funding the government for weeks last fall. And though that shutdown ultimately ended without a deal to extend the subsidies, Democrats say their tactics elevated the issue and paved the way for this vote today.
Let's tiptoe across the Capitol to the Senate, which, as we mentioned, has already rejected a three-year extension. So what happens when this House legislation leaves the House and goes to the Senate?
Well, this legislation, as it is now, is basically dead on arrival over there. But its boosters have said a strong showing in the House would recharge negotiations in the Senate, and that seems to be happening. A bipartisan group of senators has been working on compromise legislation this week, and this morning, several of them met with a group of House members, including Republican Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick of Pennsylvania. He was the first Republican to sign that discharge petition.
The senators made it abundantly clear that but for this action in the House, which we had to take the discharge route, unfortunately, that that was incredibly important for them to breathe life back into this issue and really force the Senate to take this up, which I believe they will.
Sam, as you know better than I, it's so rare these days to use those four groups, those four words in a row, a bipartisan group of senators. So tell me more about these bipartisan talks.
So Congressman Fitzpatrick described the meeting this morning as a packed House with an almost equal number of Democrats and Republicans. Several members involved in these negotiations have told reporters a deal is close. One potential sticking point, though, is that some Republicans want more stringent language around ensuring federal money is not used for abortion. President Trump earlier this week said Republicans may need to be a little flexible on this, and we've gotten, you know, conflicting readouts on how much of a problem this is going to pose.
And what do we know about what might be in this potential compromise legislation?
Senators involved in the talks say the emerging deal would be a two-year extension. In the second year, patients could choose to have funds deposited in a health savings account, something Trump has been pressing for, and open enrollment would likely be extended as well.
And just briefly, how likely is it these subsidies will get resurrected in the end?
It is not clear, though. Congressman Fitzpatrick told reporters today that if a deal does advance from the Senate, it will come back for a vote on the House floor one way or another.
NPR Sam Greenglass, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, be honest. Do you ever wait until the last minute to mail an important document, like the kind that has an actual deadline? Well, you may want to make one more New Year's resolution to change that. That's because when your mail gets postmarked is getting more complicated. NPR's Hansi Lo Wong explains.
Tens of millions of people rely on the U.S. Postal Service to vote by mail, file taxes, and send legal documents and applications. And the postmark date that USPS stamps on envelopes when it's processing mail, that date is often used to determine whether a document was sent on time. But since last year, the Postal Service has been rolling out changes in more and more places around the country.
So not only is mail in some places picked up less frequently, just once per day.
Elena Patel has been keeping track of the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center.
But also it's traveling further in a lot of cases, especially for non-local mail, before it starts being processed.
And that means some first-class mail may not get postmarked until the day after it's collected by your mail carrier, or after you drop it off at a post office or into one of those big blue collection boxes. Those changes are part of a reorganization plan that the Postal Service began 5 years ago.
By any standard, our financial situation is precarious.
And that the new Postmaster General David Steiner is continuing as the Postal Service relies on not tax dollars, but stamp and shipping fees to keep running.
No organization, even the Postal Service, can lose billions every year without consequence.
The Postal Service announced in December that it's officially changing its mailing standards to reflect the new reality. The postmark date on your letter may not necessarily match the day you mailed it. And Elena Patel, the Urban Brookings Center, says if you're a procrastinating mailer,
know that you might need to go to a post office to ensure that your postmark reflects that last minute date.
USPS says you can ask in person at the counter for a postmark free of charge. But Patel points out getting to a post office can be a challenge for people with disabilities.
The extra burden on folks in less dense and rural areas also shouldn't be overlooked. Sometimes these post offices can be 10, 20, 30 miles away where people live. And in rural areas, you know, that's a significant drive.
So in 2026, if you have an important document to mail in by a deadline, try to give yourself more time to make a plan. And if it's a mail-in ballot, consider turning it in person, like at an election office. Anzi Luong, NPR News.
Months have passed since devastating floods tore through the Texas Hill Country. The floods killed 130 people. At least two are still missing. In the aftermath of the disaster, state lawmakers approved hundreds of millions of dollars to upgrade flood warning systems. Tomorrow on All Things Considered, we'll get a dispatch from Texas on where things stand now. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 18 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. If you or someone you know is living with Parkinson's disease, there is a support group the first Tuesday of every month at 1 p.m. in the meeting room at Central Square Mall in Grand Rapids. The Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness Quota Permit will be available beginning at 9 a.m. Wednesday, January 28th for the 2026 season. Book reservations online at recreation.gov, BWCAW, or call 877-444-6777. Visitors are encouraged to review the trip planning guide and do your homework for the more than 265 backcountry campsites. And coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team. If you provide childcare for a friend or family member, there are educational resources and supplies available through the Indigenous nonprofit All Nations Rise. Items include books, trainings, first aid kits, and more. Learn more at allnationsrise.com/FFN. iLink Minnesota helps those with vision loss move forward with technology-based solutions. Your donation can bring hope and independence. Learn more by searching for iLink Minnesota online. That's the word I, spelled E-Y-E. The 20th annual Back to Basics Sustainable Living event is Saturday, February 7th at Pine River Backus School. The morning keynote and vendor fair are free and require no registration. But if you'd like to participate in workshops, register and find more info at happydancingturtle.org. The Winter Lecture Series continues at the Forest History Center in Grand Rapids, Saturday, January 17th at 1 p.m. Author Pete Caro will talk about innovations in mine land management that have led to ecological restoration.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. At WTGrantFDN.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. NASA says a crew member on the International Space Station has a serious medical issue and needs to return to Earth. The agency is cutting short an ongoing mission to bring them home. That includes the entire crew of four. It is the first time NASA has ended a mission early for a medical reason. Central Florida Public Media's Brendan Byrne is here with more. Hi.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. So, Brendan, tell us, what do we know about this medical issue on the station?
We don't know what the medical condition actually is or who it's affecting due to medical privacy, but NASA says that person is stable. We first learned about this yesterday when NASA called off a planned spacewalk today, or for today, and a decision was made to return that person for medical evaluation here on Earth. Here's NASA Administrator Jared Isaacman earlier today.
After discussions with Chief Health and Medical Officer, Dr. J.D. Polk, and leadership across the agency, I've come to the decision that it's in the best interest of our astronauts to return Crew 11 ahead of their planned departure.
That Crew 11 he's referring to is the name of the mission and made up of two NASA astronauts, one from Japan and a Russian cosmonaut. They launched on a SpaceX capsule last August, and since one crew member needs to return home due to that medical issue, they all do, since that's their only ride back. Isaacman said that will happen in the next few days since this isn't considered an emergency. Instead, he says it's a medical evacuation.
And as we mentioned, Brendan, this is a first for NASA. So how is the agency prepared for a situation like this one?
The NASA administrator said this is what training's for. I spoke with Paul Dye. He was a flight director for NASA on both the space shuttle and space station programs. He said while the agency has never had to bring a crew back early for medical reasons, that doesn't mean he and his team weren't prepared.
We always have plans for bringing crew members back because if you have an emergency that you can't deal with, which is rare, but if you ran into a case in training where you couldn't deal with it, everybody goes to their escape vehicle, and then when we decide that we can't sustain them up on orbit, then we bring them home.
Dye told me Mission Control always has plans to bring a crew home in case of an emergency, medical, or other things like a fire or space debris. It's just not something they've ever needed to do before.
And an unprecedented situation like this one, what goes into the decision to bring a crew home early?
Crew safety is first and foremost the priority for NASA. That was echoed by the administrator today. And Dye explained to me that flight surgeons are in touch with the crew aboard the station. They relay information back to mission controllers to make that decision. The controllers then plan for that what that would mean for the station. So if the crew has to cut the mission short, like it is doing now, that means maintenance, like that spacewalk that was canceled and an active science experiments would be abandoned. Here's Don Platt, an engineer at Florida Tech who helped build the space station.
It's a significant problem. This is something that they've dealt with before. Basically, the crew members that are there are pretty much just concentrating on making sure the space station can continue to run.
And Brendan, lastly, what about the crew members? Do we know how they're doing?
We're told the crew handled the issue as trained, and they are ready to complete the mission, albeit a few weeks early. Let's keep in mind the space station has been continuously occupied since 2000. One major medical incident like this in more than two decades is a testament to that training preparedness. NASA actually expected this to happen more often. And once the crew departs, there will be only three people on the station who would be joined next month by the next rotation of astronauts on SpaceX's Crew 12 mission.
That was Central Florida Public Media's Brendan Byrne. Brendan, thank you so much.
Anytime.
Lassen Volcanic National Park in far northern California is a rugged wonderland of lava flows, cinder cones, and boiling pools. It is also dotted with welcoming meadows and alpine lakes, places a small brown frog once called home. The last known Cascades frog vanished from the park in 2007. It was wiped out by a deadly fungus that's ravaging frog populations worldwide. The frogs still exist elsewhere in the Pacific Northwest, but a determined band of biologists is set on bringing them back to Lassen Volcanic National Park. Ryan Wagner is one of those biologists. He is a PhD candidate at Washington State University and joins me now. Welcome.
Hello.
Ryan, let's go back to 2007, if we can, with this one last frog that scientists knew of in the park. What can you tell me about her and why she disappeared?
There was this one final female Cascades frog that every spring would move down to the larger breeding pools, and she'd sit there and wait and listen for males calling. And she wouldn't hear them because she was the last one. And biologists watched her for several years, lingering until one year she was gone. And biologists haven't seen a Cascades frog in Lassen Volcanic National Park since.
And if we fast forward nearly 20 years, you and a team of scientists took on this mission of reintroducing these Cascades frogs to the national park. But if I understand it correctly, you gave the frogs a special bath first, is that right?
That's right. We bathed them in a highly dilute antifungal bath, and we bathed them for just 5 minutes every day for about a week in this antifungal to kill off the fungus that's causing these population declines. And that allows us to give them a better chance of survival when we reintroduce them.
How did you actually just like physically transport the frogs into the park?
We used little Tupperware containers. We put one frog per deli cup. We put a little bit of wet sphagnum moss in there. And then we loaded them into a cooler, drove them to the release site, and then loaded them all into backpacks. We had volunteers and other biologists place all of these frogs into hiking day packs, and then we hiked several miles to the release site and released each one at the water's edge.
What was the moment like when you let those first frogs go?
It felt like a really big moment for the Cascades frog. These were the first individuals to re-enter their historic home. And it's a really hopeful moment, I think, for Cascades frogs and for amphibians in general, since we've been seeing these declines.
Given the fact that the fungus is still likely out there in these environments, is there a danger that the frogs might get reinfected, potentially die off again?
The frogs could become reinfected. But one of the things that we know about Cascades frogs is that the metamorph life stage right after they turn into froglets from tadpoles is the most sensitive life stage to infections with this fungus. And so we're hoping to treat these frogs when they're little, and we're going to continue to monitor these populations and potentially conduct future baths in future years to keep them resilient against this chytrid fungus.
Have you been able to go back out to see the frogs since that trip in September when you first reintroduced them?
I have. We went back out about 3 weeks later, and we did re-find many of our released frogs. And so we think that's a good sign that they've survived that initial reintroduction. Now the next hurdle is to see how do they fare over winter. It's now winter in Lassen. All of the snow and ice has laid out over the ponds and the meadows, and the frogs are overwintering under the water there. And so we're going to go back out in the spring and try to re-find our frogs to understand how did they do and what needs to happen next.
That's wildlife biologist Ryan Wagner. He's a PhD candidate at Washington State University. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This is NPR News.
It is 529, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is the Up North Report. Chair has a free community meal Sunday, January 18th at their location on Chestnut Street in downtown Virginia from noon to 3. The event also offers food and clothing distribution to those in need. If you have items to donate, you may bring them to Chair at any time. Now it's time for the Up North Report here on KAXE KBXE.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with the Up North Report. The ICE agent who fatally shot a Minneapolis woman Wednesday has been identified, and the FBI has barred state law enforcement agencies from investigating the death. Chelsea Perkins has more.
Jonathan Ross is the same agent who was dragged by a vehicle and injured in June of last year during an ICE operation in Bloomington, according to court records reviewed by the Minnesota Star Tribune. The Star Tribune says little other public information on Ross is available as of its reporting on Thursday afternoon. Governor Tim Walz is blasting the FBI for forcing out the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension from the investigation into the death of Renee Nicole Good. He says the likelihood of a fair outcome feels very difficult.
There's a BCA Force Investigations Unit that was created by the legislature, by the people of Minnesota, to provide an independent, consistent, and trusted mechanism for investigating the use of force incidents involving law enforcement officers.
And he evoked George Orwell's novel 1984 in relation to the federal government's version of the killing, which conflicts with video footage and eyewitness accounts. Walz commended the thousands who attended the Minneapolis vigil Wednesday night for Good, who leaves behind a wife and child. The governor also pointed to Minnesota's place in history, offering one of the first regiments for the Union Army during the Civil War.
The nation's looking to us to hold the line on democracy, to hold the line on decency, to hold the line on accountability, and more than that, to rise up as neighbors and simply say, we can look out for one another, we can have differences, but we've proved to the world going on 250 years that our democracy could hold.
8th District Congressman Pete Stauber reacted to Walz's remarks on social media, writing, quote, in a time when Minnesotans need calm, reasonable, and steady leadership, Tim Walz threatens to use our National Guard sons and daughters to wage a civil war against the federal government. Minnesotans deserve so much better than Tim Walz. Protests against ICE and vigils in Good's memory are taking place across the country. A vigil is planned in Bemidji on Friday night. Chelsea Perkins, KAXE News.
The Hibbing School District will soon be without a superintendent and a business manager. The school board will have an emergency meeting 11 a.m. Friday to interview and select an acting superintendent after posting the position internally. Superintendent Rick Aldrich resigned at Wednesday's board meeting. Though his resignation isn't effective until April 14th, Aldrich is on medical leave until April. Business manager Alex Kaiser resigned in December, effective January 15th. The vacancies come as the district begins planning $2 million in budget cuts. Aldrich is not leaving because of the district's financial situation, but because of a health condition, and Kaiser resigned to take a position in the Grand Rapids School District. The Minnesota Department of Health is aligning its immunization guidance with Professional Medical Association recommendations rather than the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The CDC overhauled the childhood immunization schedule earlier this week to reduce the number of routinely recommended vaccines. The agency used to recommend vaccination against 17 infectious diseases. The new guidance drops that number to 11, recommending only high-risk groups get the remainder of the shots. State Commissioner of Health Dr. Brooke Cunningham says the change does not reflect the best available science. While the immunization schedule will no longer align with the CDC, the guidance itself remains the same. Minnesota will continue to recommend children routinely receive vaccines to protect from hepatitis, bacterial meningitis, rotavirus, and the flu, COVID, and RSV. Two northern Minnesota sheriffs announced they will seek re-election in November. Itasca County Sheriff Joe Dasovich cites the accomplishments of his first term and his wish to continue building on that work. Beltrami County Sheriff Jason Riggs is also seeking re-election for a second term. He cites his two-decade law enforcement career of serving the county and its communities. Wadena County Sheriff Michael Carr announced Wednesday he was ending his 32-year law enforcement career, opting not to seek a seventh term. Carr says the office is a turnkey operation and well-positioned for the future. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services, such as budgeting and forecasting. yptc.com/NPR. From Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at au.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Five Senate Republicans joined with Democrats to advance a resolution to stop President Trump from ordering new unilateral military action against Venezuela. Here is Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer following that vote.
It's a clear rejection of the idea that one person can unilaterally send American sons and daughters into harm's way without Congress, without debate.
It marks the largest Republican rebuke of Trump's policy on Venezuela after last weekend's military raid that ousted President Nicolas Maduro. Joining us now is NPR congressional correspondent Claudia Grisales. Hi.
Hi, Juana.
So, Claudia, the same bipartisan group, which was largely led by Democrats, it's forced several votes to limit Trump's war powers, but there have been mixed results. So tell us what's different.
Well, quite a bit. As we know, President Trump demands fierce loyalty from this Republican-led Congress, and his party has largely stayed in line. But seeing five Senate Republicans break ranks today signals Congress may not have the same appetite as the White House for expansion of military action against Venezuela. Tim Kaine, the Virginia Senate Democrat who co-led this effort, said members learned through Trump-led classified briefings this week that a lot of information about this operation has been withheld from the public.
We know a lot that we can't describe. Once folks start to get deeper and deeper into this, I think they're not going to like it.
And he says that's partly a reason why more Republicans are shifting to support this. And Democrats and even some Republicans argue there's still a lot of questions about the next steps, such as the potential for the U.S.-Venezuela conflict to continue for the next year or more, the cost to the American public, expansion of this conflict to other countries, and more.
The success of this vote apparently came as quite a surprise to other Republicans who voted against the measure. Have we heard from the Republicans who broke ranks?
Yeah, many have pointed to the same concerns about whether this could lead to another endless war. Kentucky GOP Senator Rand Paul has co-led several of these efforts with Kaine. I asked him what is his biggest concern at this stage.
I want to make sure that the war doesn't spread throughout South America or throughout the Caribbean, and that there's diplomatic alternatives.
Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Josh Hawley of Missouri, and Todd Young of Indiana joined Paul and Democrats to vote yes, some for the first time. And that includes Young. He was a no on three war powers related votes last year, but a yes today. And he said while he applauded bringing Maduro to justice, he believes the vast majority of the state is not prepared to commit troops to Venezuela.
Claudia, have we heard any response from President Trump at this point?
Yeah, quickly after the vote, he lashed out at those five Senate Republicans on his social media site. He said the party should, quote, be ashamed of these GOP members and they should never be elected to office again. And he argued, despite their, quote, stupidity, that the War Powers Act is unconstitutional. But of course, we know that's not clear in this case. It's also worth noting here that some of these lawmakers, like Senator Collins, are in a tight election race come this November.
That's right. Claudia, last thing. What's next?
Well, this sets up a series of votes next week in the Senate. The first is a procedural vote, and if that passes, it would lead 2 hours of debate, potentially more votes before a bid for final passage. But as we saw in that post by the president, he seemed to warn Republicans who sided with Democrats to reconsider their positions. So they're going to have a lot of weight on their shoulders if they break ranks again.
NPR congressional correspondent Claudia Grisales, thank you.
Thank you.
If you're a dog owner, have you ever had to spell out words like W-A-L-K or T-R-E-A-T so your pet would not overhear and get all excited? I did this very thing this morning with the family Bernedoodle. Turns out a lot of dogs can listen in to humans talking to each other and pick out key words. And it turns out a small number of them can do something even more impressive. As NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports, when these dogs eavesdrop on us people, they can learn entirely new, unfamiliar words, much like toddlers do.
Your typical family dog knows some words, like the names of family members or basic commands.
They learn words that are very relevant to them.
Shani Dror is a researcher at the University of Veterinary Medicine in Vienna and ELTE University in Budapest. She says learning words can be difficult for most dogs. For example, they may know that go get the ball means they should bring you something.
But what we found in our previous studies is that they would actually really struggle to learn the difference between get me the ball and get me the frisbee.
After years of searching, she and her colleagues have identified a small number of genius dogs that can, for whatever reason, learn words for objects easily. She says this is an extremely rare ability in dogs, and usually their owners did not set out to teach them words.
It's just they play with the dog, they give the dog a toy, and then one day they notice the dog knows the name of the toy, and they start adding more and more toys.
Each with its own unique name that the dog learns. These dogs end up knowing dozens or even hundreds of words.
I had one woman that told me that she doesn't want to count so her husband wouldn't know how many toys the dog has, but they know a lot of toys.
Dorr and her fellow researchers want to understand how these dogs do it. Their latest study in the journal Science checked whether these dogs could pick up new words even if a person's speech wasn't directed at them. For example, in one video from the study, a border collie named Basket is sitting on a couch watching two people in the room. Neither person looks at Basket or directly speaks to her as together they examine a little stuffed animal.
This is your armadillo. It has armadillo ears, little armadillo feet, has a tail, like an armadillo tail.
All of this clearly registered with Basket, because in later tests...
Get your armadillo. Go get armadillo.
Basket could race into a different room, survey a pile of toys, and grab the right one without hesitation.
Yes.
Dror says learning words like this is something normally associated with 1.5-year-old toddlers.
A lot of parents know this quite embarrassing situation where your kid is picking up words that they're not supposed to by listening to other people speak.
One language scientist who wasn't part of the research team says it is impressive that these dogs could do this. Rochelle Newman is with the University of Maryland.
We can train a lot of species to learn things about language, but usually that is very explicit. Press this button when you hear this sound and I will give you a treat.
Still, she says the speech that these dogs overheard was kind of unusual. It was pretty simple and was about something of great interest to them. What's more, she says it's important to remember these were dogs with really unusual learning abilities.
They did do a study with regular pet dogs and they didn't find anything there.
So it's hard to say what your pet dog might be learning through eavesdropping on your conversations. But if you think your dog knows the name of 5 or more toys, these researchers would love to hear from you. Nell Greenfield-Boyce, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The Trump administration is pulling out of dozens of international organizations. Nearly half of them are part of the United Nations and were created to address issues like climate change, human rights, and women's health. This decision came in an executive order yesterday, and it's part of a wider U.S. retreat from global cooperation that began when Trump took office last year. NPR Global Health correspondent Fatma Tanis joins us now. Hi.
Hi.
So start by just giving us more details about the organizations the U.S. is pulling out of, and what do they do?
Well, the big headline is that the U.S. is pulling out of a key international treaty on climate change, as well as other climate-focused organizations. But most of the groups on the list were working on issues like international security, energy, even addressing violence against women and children. Now, 31 of the organizations on the list were UN-affiliated, so that's more than half of all UN agencies. And one expert we talked to put it as, quote, an unprecedented assault on the United Nations. On the other hand, Brett Schaefer, an expert on the UN with the think tank American Enterprise Institute, told me he found the list underwhelming.
I see it as a missed opportunity. The president's original executive order talked about reassessing and realigning U.S. interests in terms of its participation in international organizations. And this is more, in my opinion, pruning around the margins.
He says the UN's largest organizations are mainly untouched by this executive order, although many of them, like UNICEF, have already had funding cuts by the administration.
Why did the administration pull out of all of these groups?
Well, Secretary of State Marco Rubio explained it in a statement. He said these organizations are advancing agendas that are, quote, a threat to our nation's sovereignty, freedoms, and general prosperity. He made a point that this was about saving taxpayer money, although the U.S. wasn't really spending a lot of money on these groups. Rubio also noted that this decision is building on the work the administration already did by dismantling USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development, last year.
How does this move fit in with that agenda?
So it's part of the administration's beef with multilateral institutions and NGOs, which they largely view as having progressive motives. But, you know, it's not really that this administration doesn't care about things like energy or counterterrorism like these organizations were working on. It's that it doesn't want to do that work. It doesn't want to collaborate with the UN on those issues.
So if they're walking away from these groups, how does the administration propose dealing with these various global issues?
Well, they want to do it by making one-on-one agreements with individual countries. But Tom Boyke with the Council on Foreign Relations says there's limitations to that approach. For one thing, it takes a really long time to make these deals. So far, the U.S. has made agreements with only 9 countries in Africa, and that's just in healthcare. Boyke also said these organizations that the U.S. has pulled out of, they already had buy-in from various countries, even ones that the U.S. is not friendly with. So withdrawing from them will be felt.
Those all will have everyday effects on Americans because it's difficult to make progress on health, climate, environment, or counterterrorism challenges that, you know, by the very nature, span borders.
There's also concern with countries like Russia and China still in these groups that the U.S. pulled out of, that the U.S. could lose out on influence on the global stage.
NPR's Fatma Tanis, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
It is 5:48, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Support for KAXE comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. Listen to the Season Watch Pod with hosts Charlie Mitchell, Heidi Holton, John Latimer, and a rotating cast of characters. Season Watch is for the curious, filled with the delights of nature. This week we meet a phenology teacher from Little Falls. Tune in Saturday at 1:30 and Sunday morning at 10:30. Support for KAXE comes from Ledger and Ladle, a restaurant in downtown Grand Rapids with a rotating menu every few months to explore a new region, technique, or ingredient. Open Wednesday through Friday, 3 to 9 p.m., Saturdays, 5 to 9, and Sundays, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. More at ledgerandladle.com. Tune in Monday morning at 7:45 for another installment of What We're Reading. Staff librarian Tammy Bobrowski talks with Minnesota writer J.R. Dawson about her latest novel, The Lighthouse at the Edge of the World. Happy Dancing Turtle invites all ages to participate in their winter bingo scavenger hunt now until January 15th. Look for 24 items on your bingo card with a special focus on animal tracks. Find a registration link and more details at happydancingturtle.org. You can try out snowshoes and kick sleds Saturday, January 10th from 10 to 2 at Lake Bemidji State Park. The park's artists and residents are wrapping up their final projects, and you can visit with them during this time as well. Light snacks provided. And it's the Back to Hack Festival in Hackensack, January 16th through the 18th. Activities include the Frostbite Your Fanny Fun Run, Snow Golf, Kids Games, Fireworks, and more.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. President Trump has made the fight against street fentanyl a major part of his agenda. But a new study published today in the journal Science shows that under Joe Biden, the flow of fentanyl into the U.S. was already plunging. Overdose deaths were also falling fast. So how did Trump win the messaging war on fentanyl during the presidential campaign while Biden was making big progress? NPR's Brian Mann has our story.
Let's start in 2024, when the presidential campaign was in its final fiery months, and Trump and the Republicans were seizing on the issue of street fentanyl as a major line of attack. Ann Fundner spoke in a primetime slot during the GOP convention about her teenage son's death from a fentanyl overdose.
His whole future, everything we ever wanted for him, was ripped away in an instant. And Joe Biden does nothing.
When asked about fentanyl during their only debate in June 2024, Trump hammered Biden, framing fentanyl as part of the wider border migrant crisis.
We were getting very low numbers, very, very low numbers. Then he came along. The numbers, have you seen the numbers now?
During that debate and during the wider campaign, Biden and then Kamala Harris echoed Trump's framing of fentanyl as a border problem still raging out of control. Here she is at a rally in Arizona.
It's a scourge in our country, and we have to take it seriously. And as president, I will make it a top priority to disrupt the flow of fentanyl coming into the United States.
NPR could find few instances throughout the campaign where candidates Biden or Harris talked about actual progress being made on fentanyl. Research shows when Harris gave that speech, the Biden team had already disrupted fentanyl smuggling dramatically. Stanford University researcher Keith Humphreys analyzed fentanyl samples collected in drug raids in 2023 and 2024.
You're looking at about a 50% decline in the purity of fentanyl that was being seized. So that's a big drop.
Humphreys is co-lead author of a new report published in the journal Science that found the purity of fentanyl and its availability on the streets in American communities dropped sharply under Biden. Humphreys thinks Biden used law enforcement to target drug cartels, then convinced China to curb the flow of chemicals needed to make fentanyl.
Biden's people, the foreign policy people, can feel very proud that they made a positive impact.
Biden officials also expanded public health and addiction treatment programs widely credited with helping save tens of thousands of lives a year. What's baffling to drug policy experts like Humphreys is that Biden and Harris never told that story to the American public.
And I think it hurt them because they had a story of success to tell.
The study by Nabarun Dasgupta, a researcher at the University of North Carolina, found that in many key battleground states that decided the presidential election, drug deaths fell even faster than the national average. Again, NPR couldn't find a single instance during the campaign where Biden or Harris talked about that progress. Dasgupta told NPR he thinks Trump simply outmaneuvered the Democrats on fentanyl.
It was brilliant rhetorically. It all became about the border and not about the empowering solutions.
NPR reached out to Kamala Harris and members of the Biden and Harris campaigns to ask about their messaging on the fentanyl issue. We also reached out to the White House and the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. They didn't respond. We were able to speak with Hunter Biden, a controversial figure pardoned by Joe Biden before he left office. Hunter Biden himself struggled with addiction and served as an informal advisor during his father's campaign. He believes Trump managed to reframe fentanyl in the public mind in ways that are still keeping Democrats off balance.
Competent governance for a nuanced issue like fentanyl doesn't equal clicks. And Trump figured that out a long time ago. He's turned it into an art form that I don't believe any Democrat or Republican has been able to counter effectively yet.
Drug policy experts interviewed for this story say the failure of Biden and Harris to tell the story of their fentanyl success brought sweeping consequences. Trump has dismantled many of Biden's fentanyl policies, including programs credited with saving lives. He continues to use the fear of fentanyl and exaggerated claims about overdose deaths to justify a range of policies from trade tariffs to an increasingly militarized drug war. Brian Mann, NPR News.
After decades in Oakland, the Athletics baseball franchise has ambitious plans to relocate to Las Vegas. Relocations are never easy, and the A's have faced their share of setbacks. The latest, the U.S. government says they can't actually get a trademark for the name Las Vegas Athletics. NPR's Rafael Nam has the story.
The Athletics have existed since 1901, first in Philadelphia, then in Kansas City, and most recently in Oakland. So with the Athletics set to move to Sin City in 2028, getting a trademark as the Las Vegas Athletics seemed easy enough. Who doesn't know the Athletics?
I'm a child of the 80s. I grew up in the 80s. The Oakland Athletics, all you have to do is mention the term athletics, and I know exactly what you're talking about.
That's Josh Gerben. He would know. He's a huge baseball fan, but he's also a trademark attorney. But in a surprise, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office weighed in. Application rejected. The reason? The Las Vegas Athletics is just not a distinctive enough name. Like, say, the Las Vegas Raiders, an NFL team that also relocated to Sin City, having also once played in Oakland, as it turns out. Gerben says he now gets it.
It just so happens this is a kind of an odd trademark.
That's because the word athletics could be used in a generic context, like the Las Vegas Athletics Complex, for example, or the Las Vegas Athletics Association, according to Gerben.
It's an odd name for a team to just call them the Athletics when they're a bunch of athletes. And so because it's on that weaker end of the spectrum, they're going to have a harder time getting the trademark registered.
The patent office is trying to answer a big question.
Is it appropriate to give a monopoly on this general term to Major League Baseball and the Athletics? And that's ultimately the decision the government has to make.
But it's not over yet for the Athletics. The rejection is essentially provisional. Right now, they're known as just the Athletics and playing in a minor league ballpark in Sacramento. But they now need work at gaining an identity as the Las Vegas Athletics by selling merchandise or putting out ads. Like when they were the Oakland Athletics and were known as the franchise that helped introduce Moneyball-type baseball analytics, and most recently for breaking hearts all over Oakland. Gerben is confident the team will get their trademark.
So they've got time. I think they're going to, they've got pretty good lawyers. I think they're going to be able to figure this one out.
And once they do, after four seasons with a losing record, just maybe the Athletics will also figure out how to start winning again. Rafael Nam, NPR News.
Make America great again. MAGA. That phrase has been part of our political ecosystem for 10 years now. But what time period in American history is President Trump referencing? Is it the 1980s? Maybe the 1950s? What about going way further back, say the 1890s? We may be living in the 21st century, but do some of President Trump's policies echo those of the 19th century? That's today on the Consider This podcast. You can listen on NPR.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. From the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, telling stories behind data and trends that shape our world today through its podcast, After the Fact. Learn more at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at kaxe.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. Minnesota State Parks offer free admission Monday, January 19th. There are 75 parks and recreation areas across the state, so you can visit an old favorite or explore somewhere new. Weather tonight, mostly cloudy skies with lows 10 to 15 degrees, north winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly to partly sunny with highs 25 to 30, northwest winds 5 to 10, evening lows 7 to 13 degrees, and Saturday, slight chance of snow and cloudy.
Hello, I'm Nick Coxell.
And I'm AC Rowe. Coming up on As It